Coming up on episode 195 of Wheel Bearings, I'll be talking about my thoughts on the 2021 Ram 1500 TRX. Cole will share her thoughts on the Hyundai Sonata Hybrid. Robbie drives the Daimler EM2 and goes for a ride in the Daimler eCascadia Semi, both electric. I have the announcement of a new Timberline sub-brand for Ford's SUVs. And Citroën comes back to the U.S. market for its Freedom Move car sharing program. All coming up next.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. All right, welcome to episode 195 of Wheel Bearings, and it seems that Robbie is still sleeping late on the West Coast, so I'm not sure where he is. Hopefully he will join us at some point along here, but I'm Sam Abu-al-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin, and this week, let's go with Sports Car Market, because I just started writing a column for them.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
All right, so Nicole.
Yes.
What have you been driving this week?
I have been driving the Hyundai Sonata Hybrid, which I like. Okay, my favorite thing, two things about this that are going to seem like silly things, but it's really a sexy looking car. Like, hybrids used to be kind of boring. They have really beautiful wheels on this car.
Or worse than boring.
Worse than boring. They were they were miserable cars a few years back. This one looks really good. Like, it really does look like a good car. It was sitting next to an Audi at Home Depot yesterday. And from the back, I'm like, you know what? These both look pretty cool from the back. And also inside, I have this pet peeve when there is no room to put anything on the center, like in the center console. Like, you can put like not even a spot for you to toss the key. And I know that people have purses or whatever. I don't. I like carry my key and my wallet in my hands. I can't put anything down there. And as soon as you use the cup holder, that's the moment I go to get my Starbucks. And now I have to take out, and I don't have anywhere to put things. I had like a cup holder, and there's a little slot between the two so you can put your phone in there. Then there's a spot in the front where you can stick your wallet and your key and whatever junk you have. I love the design of the inside of this car so you can put your stuff somewhere.
Well, I think if I recall correctly, on the hybrid, there's also a space under the console as well, right?
Yes, there is room galore in this car. And that was like the first thing I noticed, because I sit down, and also, you know, it's 2021. It's the time of COVID. So I have a little tiny little bag that has masks in it. So if I forget a mask, or my husband forgets a mask, or my kids do, that just comes with me everywhere.
Spares.
It's the spares are there. And it's not like I can leave them in the glove box because it's a press car. So I have to take it with me each week. That little bag had a little spot to sit. So
that's nice.
These seem like little silly, like not important things, but when you live with a car every day, they do start to grate on your nerves when they're not right. And yeah, well done, Hyundai. I like that.
Well, I think, you know, this is one of the advantages that we've gotten from vehicles moving away from mechanical shift levers, you know, where you have the shifter that's tied by a cable to the transmission, to just a push button electronic system. Because now all of a sudden you just have that little push button array there, and there's nothing underneath it.
Right.
And so all of a sudden that opens up all kinds of space to do other things around, in and around the console.
Yeah. But even if you have an actual shifter. Like, people have stuff. Like, you need mm-hmm. to put your, you need to put your keys somewhere. You need to put your wallet somewhere. I don't understand these that have, like, I don't have a huge phone. It's an average size phone. And I sometimes, like, I have nowhere to put it. So I'm like shoving it in my pocket. Or then you open up the little storage thing. Even in there, I've had some cars just like, literally, I can't fit my phone in there. If I can't fit my phone in that center storage thing, you haven't done enough. It doesn't, you know, it's like, account for the fact that people have little things that they need to carry with them and give us a spot to put our little stuff.
Because everybody needs a place for their stuff, as the late, great George Carlin would say.
Yes, everybody needs a place for their stuff. And the Hyundai Sonata has a place for your stuff. That made me very happy. But and it's so nice to drive. I enjoy driving it. I mean, it's, you know, the first hybrid I ever drove was a Civic way, way back when it was like Civic or Prius were your only mm-hmm. choices. So I remember, I always have that memory of what hybrids were back then. And it felt like you were driving like a lawnmower engine that would like, whee, like go right through the hood of the car at any moment. I love that this, you don't really know you're driving a hybrid until suddenly you don't hear the engine. You know, that's your only clue when it's very quiet. You don't feel the transitions. You don't notice it, which I feel like is how it should be. You shouldn't always be aware when that engine turns on and off.
Yeah. Well, one of the things when Hyundai first introduced their original Sonata hybrid, what, 2010, I think. At that point, they were one of the first automakers to go to this kind of layout using a traditional step gear, step ratio transmission. You know, so it had a conventional 6-speed automatic paired with an electric motor and the engine. Unlike the Toyota hybrids and the Fords and the Hondas that had sort of an electronic CVT continuously variable thing, where, you know, in those, like you talked about, you know, you get that buzzing from the engine because you get on the accelerator, the engine revs up to its torque peak and then just sits there. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's that what they call a motorboating effect that is really kind of unpleasant to drive, you know. And even on a non-hybrid with a CVT, a lot of CVTs behave like that. It's
right.
It's just not very pleasant.
It's why CVTs get a bad rap, and rightly so, because they just don't sound nice. Nobody wants to listen to that. And I mean, they're better. They're getting better. I mean, each iteration, each time an OEM comes out with a new one, it feels like they're a little bit better and they do a little bit more work to sort of dampen that sound. So even if it's doing that, you're not hearing it quite so much, you know, driving the car, riding inside of it. But yeah, that's never what you never want to hear your engine in a way or working that you think, is something breaking? Am I pushing on that accelerator too hard? Am I about to kill my car? And that's what they kind of sound like sometimes. I don't like that. So I appreciate that this just feels and sounds like driving a normal, you know, a regular gas powertrain with, you know, they just have a regular automatic transmission in there. You have no idea that there's any hybrid stuff happening there until you're aware of that, like the sudden silence, which is a nice silence. And it doesn't even have a particularly, it has the sound that it makes. We were talking about this before the show, like they have to make a sound under a certain speed so that you don't accidentally, you know, hit pedestrians. The idea being the pedestrians won't hear you if the car makes absolutely no sound and they're more likely to step in front of your car by accident. This one makes a sound that's, I'm okay with the sound. It's okay. Some of them are annoying. I still haven't found anything as annoying as the internal beep that the Prius makes in reverse, which makes me want to like stab my eyes out. It's so annoying. I don't understand that, but this one isn't bad. So.
Yeah, it's fairly subtle. It's, you know, it's just enough that people outside the vehicle are going to hopefully notice it.
Right.
You know, if you're trolling around a parking lot or something like that, and, you know, somebody with low vision, you know, to alert them that, you know, or even actually even somebody that can see, just to alert them, you know, if they're not paying attention, you know, that there's a vehicle approaching, because you don't have the sound of the engine. What kind of fuel economy did you get out of this one?
I looked yesterday and I've been driving mostly like city driving. I haven't been on the highway that much. And I think I was averaging somewhere around 44 and change. So not bad. I mean, I think that's pretty good. I forget. I'm trying to look at the official, what do they say? They say 47 combined is what the official mm-hmm. number is. And I think I was like 44.1, 44.2 last time I looked. So I'm in the zone for that. So pretty close.
So you're slacking then, because I think when I drove it last year, I got closer to 50.
Oh, I mean, I got closer to 50. I wasn't trying. I was just driving it like a normal person. I wasn't trying to hypermile.
Hey, I mean, if you can get 44 miles per gallon out of, you know, a pretty good size family sedan like that, you know, that also happens to have halfway decent performance.
Yeah,
that's, you know, I'd say that's fine. You know, and the reality is, you know, if you, you know, as you go up in miles per gallon, because of the way miles per gallon works out, and you look at how much fuel you're actually saving, every additional 1 mile per gallon you get, you're reducing the total, you're reducing the amount of fuel that you're saving. So like when you go from 10 to 20 miles per gallon, you're saving a lot more fuel than if you go from 30 to 40 or 40 to 50. And so the difference in how much fuel you actually consume, how much you use over the course of a year, with a car that's getting 45, you know, if you're getting 44 or 45 miles per gallon versus 50, it's inconsequential. I mean, right. You're talking, you know, probably less than, you know, $50, $75 a year worth of fuel. So it's a very small savings. So it's, you know, if anything in the 40s, I think you're doing great.
You're doing good. And it, I guess, would be more important right now if you're driving a hybrid, because what I think it was yesterday, there was that hack of that one pipeline. I don't know if you saw that news. So supposedly it supplies 40-something% of the fuel to the East Coast, and the pipeline was hacked, and now everyone's panicking about fuel prices. So we'll see if next week we're going, oh God, oh God, oh God, we don't have gas, prices are $10 a gallon. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there's been, some reports that, you know, we can expect to see higher fuel prices this summer as well, because, you know, more people are going to be traveling, you know, as they get vaccinated, you know, trying to get back to something resembling a normal life. So, you know, having that extra fuel economy will definitely help. And, you know, down the road, you know, if we start to see higher fuel taxes or anything like that, you know, it never hurts to have extra fuel economy.
Exactly. It's a good thing. It puts money back in your pocket one way or the other, whether you drive a little or a lot, it does add up over time. I think what too, you know, so many people have been home for the last year, you know, working at home, not even forget the vacations and stuff, just working at home. And you sort of gotten used to whatever your monthly gas bill is what it is right now. And when everyone goes back to work, it's going to be this shock. Oh gosh, I got to stop at the gas station more than once a month to put gas in my car. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So in the one that you were driving, the electric motor that's part of the powertrain isn't the only source of electricity into the battery.
It is not.
You had another feature on there.
I did. We also have the solar roof on my Sonata Hybrid, which looks really snazzy. And it was funny. My husband looked at it and sort of did a double take, like, what? Oh, cool. That's solar. My 17-year-old looked at it and said, what's wrong with your roof? Like, it just didn't register at all that that's what she was looking at. So, I mean, it's a cool thing, but we were talking about this again. I don't know how much, you know, we're in New Hampshire where I get a modest amount of sun and it's not particularly strong in the month of May. So I don't know how much I'm actually getting in terms of improved fuel economy, but maybe if you lived in California where the sun was blazing hot almost every day of the year and you got full sun no matter where you parked, but that's not the case here. So I think it's nifty, but I don't know how much it's helping.
Yeah. According to Hyundai, if the car is parked, you know, in direct sunlight, you know, with the sun shining on that roof, you can fully charge the hybrid battery in about 6 hours, which means, you know, that 6 hours will get you about a mile and a half of electric driving, you know, which is about what you'd get from a full charge. You know, if the battery is fully charged and you put it in EV mode, you know, you'll get about a mile and a half of driving. Yeah. You know, because hybrids are not, you know, normal hybrids are not really designed for, you know, electric driving, except for very short distances at lower speeds. You know, it's designed to assist and recapture energy from your braking and things like that. But, you know, the thing is, you know, the roof of the car is not flat. And solar panels are very subject to, you know, actually being angled towards the sun. You know, the angle that the rays of the sun hit the panel have a huge effect on the efficiency of, you know, how much power it can generate. And when I had one, I think, you know, I had it parked outside in the sun for a full day, and I think it barely got like half of a charge.
Oh, really?
And the thing is, there's actually a little meter in the instrument cluster, in the digital instrument cluster, that shows you the charging power you're getting from the solar panel. There's like a little 4-bar gauge in there, and you know, as you're driving down the road, you can actually see, like, if, you know, if you're driving, like, I live in a neighborhood where, you know, this, we've got lots of trees, and, you know, drive under the shade of a tree, you can see it drop,
you know,
down to nothing, and then come back up again when you get in the sunlight, when you're in when you're out of the shadow. So, you know, it's really more of a gimmick than anything that's going to get you any significant amount of power for driving. But where it actually can be interesting, and I can't remember if the Sonata can do this or not. I know previously in the past, like Toyota has offered a solar panel on the roof, and a couple of other manufacturers have offered rooftop solar panels that could be used just to, you know, to power the ventilation system in the car. So when you're parked out in the sun, you know, you can pop the sunroof open, or, you know, or just, you know, just run the ventilation fan inside to, so it doesn't get quite so hot inside the cabin of the car. You know, that could be useful.
That would be cool.
Yeah. But I don't think the Hyundai system can do that.
You know, I'm going to be honest and say, I don't know. I don't think that it does, but don't quote me on that. I could be wrong on that. I don't see anything about that. And if it does, I didn't know that it did that. So there you go.
Yeah. So, you know, solar roofs are cool, but not really that useful on a car. And it also means that if you get the solar roof, you can't get the sunroof.
I know. So. That's the thing. It's funny. I went to open, because we've had some decent weather here, and I went to open the sunroof that doesn't exist. I was like, oh, wait, it's finally sunny and there's no roof on this car that I can open.
So how much was that Sonata hybrid?
Slightly chopped off of my form, $36,000 and change. So, not bad. And that's for the Sonata Hybrid Limited. And I mean, it's got a lot of features. It's, you feel like it's, you don't feel like there's anything missing on this. You know, you've got a nice, comfortable, well-equipped sedan. So 36 and change. And for, what do we say, a combined 47 MPG, that's, you know, it's a pretty good deal.
Yeah. You can't complain about that.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put it this way. I would rather drive around in that Sonata Hybrid than in a Prius.
Oh, yeah. I know. I feel like we're knocking Toyota. Sorry, Toyota. But yeah, would.
Well, you know, I mean, the current generation Prius actually drives really well.
Yes.
But it's really hard to look at.
It's the style thing. And you know what? I feel like I'm going to say it. I feel like there's like an attitude that comes with Prius. Like you drive a Sonata Hybrid. You drive a Sonata Hybrid. You happen to have bought a hybrid. People might not even notice that you're driving a hybrid. It doesn't scream like, I'm a hybrid. I'm green. I'm fuel efficient. Go me. You get into a Prius and it's like, oh yeah, I care about the environment. So I'm buying a Prius. So I'm like, I feel like it's making a statement in a way.
Virtue signaling. I mean,
it's virtue signaling.
For a long time, that was the thing, especially in California where people were buying Priuses, you know, when the Prius was basically the only hybrid you could get. You know, a lot of people who were, you know, wanted to show their green credentials, you know, they would buy a Prius. You know, nowadays, you know, you go to California and, you know, Priuses are taxi cabs.
Right.
You know, and, you know, the Tesla Model 3s and Model S's are, you know, I think we're past the virtue signaling stage with those now, but you know, the Prius is now the new Camry of California.
It is. That's a good way to put it. Nope. We didn't buy,
not the Prius. I mean, the Tesla is the Camry of California.
We didn't the reason we had a Civic Hybrid back when they did them was because my husband at the time didn't want a Prius because he's like, I don't want that attitude. I'm not that guy.
And you want something that looks more normal.
He's like, I want a normal looking car. I don't leave like, oh, look at him. He got a Prius. He's like, no. I just have a really long commute and I can't afford gas right now. That's it.
I had the opposite of the
you
Prius.
Did were we more like almost carbon neutral, not even close with what you were driving?
No, it was the anti-carbon neutral.
Yes.
And this, you know, this vehicle kind of represents the, along with one other, kind of represents, I think, most likely the end of an era. So I had the Ram 1500 TRX crew cab 4x4.
Woo-hoo. So
this is the, you know, the Ram pickup with the Hellcat V8, the supercharged Hellcat V8. And, you know, right now, for the moment, at least, this is the most powerful and fastest pickup that you can get anywhere. Full size pickup. At least until the Hummer EV hits the road this fall. And it has 702 horsepower from the supercharged 6.2 liter V8. It sounds amazing. I mean, for anybody who's an automotive enthusiast, you know, who likes the sound of great engines. I mean, this thing sounds fantastic. You know, it's got that rumble and roar. It's definitely not something that you're going to sneak out of the neighborhood early in the morning.
Definitely not.
It's not like, you know, like Ford on the Mustang a few years ago, they introduced what they called their good neighbor mode, you know, for the dual mode exhaust. You know, so it's a quiet mode for the exhaust. So
right.
As you're pulling out of your driveway in the morning, or if you're coming in late, you know, you can pop it into quiet mode and it doesn't make quite so much noise. Not on this thing. There's nothing, absolutely nothing toned down about this truck. So this is, you know, the TRX is Stellantis's response to the F-150 Raptor. But then, you know, turned up to 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the previous generation Raptor and the initial versions of the new one that are not on sale yet, they should be hitting dealerships sometime this spring, use Ford's 4.5 liter EcoBoost or 3.5 liter EcoBoost V6, you know, with about 450 horsepower. The TRX, as I said, over 700 horsepower. It's got these Bilstein remote reservoir dampers on it. It's lifted up. It's got great big tires on it. It's got, you know, the full boat solution, you know, for off-roading, four-wheel drive low mode, real four-wheel drive system. It had the optional 12-inch Uconnect infotainment system.
I love that.
And I, you know, driving this thing, it's been a couple of years since I drove a Raptor. But the thing I remembered about the previous generation Raptor, and I haven't driven the new one yet, but the previous generation Raptor always felt really soft in the suspension. You know, it's got a lot of wheel travel. You know, it's designed for high-speed off-road running. But when you're driving it on the street, it just felt kind of soft and sloppy. And, you know, when you're going around a corner, you could feel the body roll. You know, if you hit the brakes, you feel it diving. And it just never felt very confident to me. Yeah, this thing, this has got the same kind of vehicle dynamics and, you know, body control, wheel control that I experienced with the Gladiator Mojave, you know, which was their first desert rated model. The TRX doesn't technically have the desert rating that Jeep is planning to add to others, but it's got that same kind of feel. It's really well controlled. You know, it's still comfortable. You know, it doesn't pound you as you're driving on the street, you know, hitting potholes and things like that. But I took it out, you know, onto some back roads near me here, you know, some bumpy dirt roads. I didn't have a chance to do any real off-roading with it, but, you know, going on on bumpy dirt roads, you know, where we'd had some heavy rain and, you know, so it was some pretty good potholes. You know, I did a few launches on there. 0 to 60 and without launch control in 3.7 seconds, with launch control turned on 3.4 seconds. This is on gravel.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this thing weighs 3 tons. It's a 6,000 pound truck empty.
Yeah.
And, because it's designed for off-roading, it's got running boards that are tucked right up against the body. So they're really almost useless because, you know, they don't stick down for you. It's a high step up into the cab of this thing.
Sure, so you're reaching. People will not like it.
Yeah. Rebecca would not have a good time with
this.
She's
just going to dangle from the steering wheel as she tries to pull herself up.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, I mean, there are grab handles on both A pillars, on the driver's side and the passenger side. But yeah, it's a pretty good step up into this thing. But it drives great, which is characteristic of the Ram 1500. You know, ever since the previous generation when they launched it with coil springs, it's had the best driving dynamics of any pickup truck.
Yeah. So I had a chance to drive this too when they launched it back in October. I want to say it was late October of last year. They did a drive program and they had us take it off road. They had us on some twisties. It was sort of like in a mountainy area. We're somewhere in California. I can't even remember where now. But I agree with you about the on-road handling. That is a big off-road truck. It is nothing petite or small about it, but it handled really well. We're on a highway where the speed limit's a good like 55 miles an hour, but those big swooping, you know, curves you get as you're going along on a mountain, and it's very controlled. You feel it's surprisingly controlled. And then they had us take it on a dirt track where we really got to push it and catch some air in it. And honestly, the thing that was funny, you know, they had someone in the right seat. It's not like you were driving this on your own. And as you, you know, hit certain speeds, like when you at least hit this much so that you catch some air when you come down the other side, you don't even feel it. And like, I'm watching these guys and I'm saying like, was I much lower than that? I was like, no, that's about what you were doing, the same thing. And I'm watching how high they are and how they're coming down. I'm like, really? Because it didn't feel that way on the inside. And the inside, you're kind of like, oh, boom. Like it's so controlled and it's so smooth, but I'm watching him from the outside. You're like, oh my gosh, bam. You don't feel that on the inside at all. So it was a joy to drive that. It was really fun. It was nice to be able to have a situation where you could, like, I'm not going to do that on my own with a press car. Take it off road and jump it. Like, no. But if Ram says, hey, we have this track, we're going to put a guy in this car with you, we're going to let you push this, and we're going to make sure that you know what you're doing, and you're in, you know, an environment where it's okay for the truck, it's okay for you, all that'll work. And it's like, okay, I'll do it. And I'm not someone who does that every day. And it was so easy to do and so comfortable and just a redonkulous amount of fun. Like, I really enjoyed it. And what you were saying about the sound of that, yeah, I'd wake up all the neighbors and I wouldn't care because it just sounds so good. I'd be like, hey guys, look what I got. Vroom, vroom, vroom.
Yeah. With the 5-inch tailpipes on the back there, you know, it's nuts, you know, and there is no logical reason for anybody to buy this thing.
No, absolutely not.
It's, you know, it's ridiculous. But you know,
it's a completely like stupid, unnecessary, over the top truck. And I love it.
Yeah. And, we were talking about fuel economy with the Sonata hybrid.
So it matched the Sonata, right? It like did better. Yeah. Way better. Right.
No. I barely got 10 miles per gallon average.
But worth, if you were
EPA rated at 12 combined, I barely got 10.
So you got 10. So worth it to have one. Oh my gosh, that's one, like a third, less than a third of the gas mileage to snub it, worth it for the fun of driving it?
It's got a 33 gallon gas tank in it. So, I mean, you know, it's not like you're going to be, you know, filling it up every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So that helps. But if you actually, you know, want something, you know, to go off-roading in, you know, and if you're going off-roading, I mean, if you're going rock crawling in, in tight canyons and trails and so on, you know, this thing probably isn't the best choice because it is so big.
It's just,
you know,
big.
It's just like 5 inches wider than a standard Ram because you've got those big bulging fenders. It's got a wider track, but you know, if there's enough room to fit this thing, you can go pretty much anywhere. I mean, it's got skid plates galore, covering all the important bits on the bottom, big steel skid plates, which is why it weighs 6,000 pounds empty. and a heavy duty frame and every, you know, a reinforced frame. And on those big tires, you've got lots of ground clearance, high approach and departure angles. So that's not a problem. But, you know, if you want to get into the tight stuff, you know, something the size of a Wrangler is actually probably a much better choice.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're, you know, if you wanted to, like, go to, you know, race in the Baja 1000, you know, this wouldn't be a terrible choice.
Yeah.
You know, it could probably handle that with, you know, just add a roll cage and you'd be fine. You know,
you're right on the size, because they did have, what they had us do was highway driving the track. And then they had one very small like bit where we're just climbing up a rocky, slope, and they had some spotters there, a little left, a little right, you know, had us, and they were sort of loose, large rocks. And it handled it no problem, but it was this giant swath of rocks. You know, it's there's nothing on either side that was going to take part of your car with it. You know, you need a big space. And even some of the tight turns as you're going through, it's like, that would not be tight in a smaller vehicle. In this, you kind of think, okay, they said it can make it through here, so I'm going to believe them. You know, it feels big.
It had power folding mirrors. So, I mean, you can at least tuck those in.
But, you know, the rest of the truck. But
fortunately, this, you know, the one I had also had the digital camera mirror inside, mm-hmm. which is great because now I could actually see behind me. Because, again, when you're up so high, you can't, you know, anything within 20 feet behind you, you're not going to see it.
Right.
You know, at least, you know, maybe farther back. So the camera mirror system, you know, is great for being able to see what's behind you. There's also, you can also turn on at speeds below 20 miles an hour. You can turn on the front camera. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, help get a little help maneuvering around. You know, it's not quite like what GM's promising for the Hummer EV, where I think it's going to have something like 18 cameras available so you can see everything underneath and around. And
I can't wait to see what that image looks like on the infotainment screen. Like, how are they getting all of those cameras to show you one cohesive image? Like, how? Yeah. I don't know how that's going to work. It'll be cool to see.
But, you know, as I said, you know, this truck, you know, it starts at $70,000, you know, $69,995. And it's $1,700 delivery charge. This is something we talked about previously, is FCA or Stellantis's delivery charge now is up to $1,700 on the trucks and SUVs. So, I mean, really that should be bundled into the base price. So you're really looking at a minimum of, you know, almost $73,000. $72,000 for this thing.
It is not a cheap toy, but it is a fun toy.
And the one I had, you know, with the various options on here, came to $87,370 total.
So $87,000 plus the $1,700, then still on top of that. So you're looking at almost
that includes the $1,700. So all in $87,000, and that included the almost $8,000 TRX Level 2 equipment group and a bunch of other options. So, you know, the one thing about, you know, the Ram crew cabs is the cab is huge. If you're relegated to the back seat, I mean, that's like riding in a limousine.
Yes, it is huge.
There's a ton of legroom back there. Mm-hmm. So whether you want to fold it up and put stuff in there and lock it away, or you know, if you're just going to have passengers back there, you've got lots of room to work with. Ram doesn't offer, you know, some of the cool, neat features that are on the new F-150, like the pop up and lockable cargo area underneath the second row seat, mm-hmm. that you have there. But you know, it does still offer a lot of neat things because of the wide fenders on the TRX. You can't get the Ram box option on this, which is one of those unique features that Ram has had for more than a decade now. But nobody else has offered it, which is nice. You know, if you're actually using your truck for truckie type things, you know, you have those Ram boxes on the side of the bed that you can put tools and stuff into.
You can't get that on the TRX. Like I was talking about the center console of the Sonata.
It's a place for your stuff. But I mean, this thing is really, you know, really comfortable to drive, stupid fast, stupid loud. You know, it does have, you know, because of the high ride height, towing capability is reduced, you know, so you only have 8,100 pound towing capability,
only 8,100 pounds.
You know, if you need the maximum towing, you know, 12,500 pounds towing, you need to go for one of the regular Rams. But you know, 8,100 is enough for most people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as I was saying, you know, this is kind of like the end of an era. You know, they'll probably build these for a couple of years. And then, you know, it'll probably go away. The Durango Hellcat that is actually in my driveway right now. That's a 1 year only thing. So I actually, at one point on Tuesday, I actually had 1400 horsepower.
I saw that picture you put up, all the horsepower in your driveway.
Yeah. You know, and I had a conversation earlier this week. There's an article in the Detroit News about, you know, kind of where Dodge, you know, Ram goes from here, because Dodge, you know, the Dodge brand in particular has become, you know, a muscle car brand for Stellantis. You know, over the last few years, you know, they pared it down. Basically, now you just have the Durango, the Challenger, and the Charger, and all of them are available with big V8s and Hellcats. And you know, we talked about, you know, where does it go from where does that brand go from here? And really, you know, I think it's what you saw on the Wrangler 4xe, you know, going electrified, adding, you know, probably, you know, we'll probably see at least a hybrid version of, you know, these future trucks and cars and SUVs and, you know, probably a plug-in hybrid, you know, because you can get enough extra power out of there that, you know, probably not with with the supercharger, but, you know, maybe with the new inline six, twin turbo inline six that Stellantis has been working on with a plug-in hybrid. I mean, you know, you're going to get, you know, probably pretty close to the same kind of performance as you get out of this thing.
But the sound, I like this. Yeah, I know. You're going to lose that. Are we getting at a point where now when those of us like,
well, if you do the V8 with a hybrid, you can still have the V8.
That's true.
Excuse me, the V8 sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, when you go off road, you just, you know, switch it off and, you know, go nice and quiet, just like with the Wrangler 4xe. You know, and I think in addition to this one, you know, Ford is going to be doing a Raptor R version of the new Raptor, which rumor has it, you know, there's no confirmation yet from Ford. Rumor has it that it's going to have the 760 horsepower supercharged V8 from the from the GT500 in there.
Ooh.
So these two are, I think, are the last that we're likely to see like this. And everything else after this is going to be electric. You know, the Hummer,
I get it. And I think you're probably right. I mean, it probably is the end. I don't want it to be the end, though. I just like the, I know gas guzzling trucks, terrible, killing the environment. Pandas are dying because of it, whatever. But I like the feel and the sound and the visceral experience of it. And I'll be sad when that sort of goes away. I know the performance can still eventually, the performance can be duplicated, but the feel
it's,
of it.
It's not the same kind of experience.
It's not the same kind of experience. And maybe it's like, it's going to make us all old farts as that happens. Like, I remember when I was a kid in the V8s and blah, blah, blah. But I like that experience. It's like manuals slowly disappearing. Like, you know, there was a time when everyone knew how to drive a manual and there was a certain experience of driving a manual transmission where you got to do the footwork and you got to shift the gears with your hands and as opposed to paddle shifters or whatever. There's a certain experience you lose. And I feel it's kind of the same way. Eh.
Yeah, I remember back in early 2008 when I did the first drive of the Tesla Roadster for Autoblog, and it was the same kind of thing. You know, driving this thing in Northern California up along Skyline Drive, you know, near Silicon Valley. You know, this was an amazing sports car. You know, fantastic handling. You know, it was like driving. You know, I mean, because it was derived from the Lotus Elise platform, and you know, you had a lot of similarity in the way it felt, and it was really fast, but you know, without the sound, it was such a different experience.
And, right.
You know, you do lose that visceral component, but you know, it is what it is. We gotta evolve. We gotta keep
move
on. Forward.
Yes. I guess it's what's coming. And it's not that I dislike the way EVs drive. I mean, they're a great experience, but they're different. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm just glancing over at the Monroney here for the TRX. It says on there, you know, they have the comparison against average vehicles for fuel consumption or fuel.
Oh God,
cost.
How bad is it?
you spend $12,750 more in fuel costs over 5 years.
Only $12,000.
They have the little ratings there for fuel economy and greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
1 to 10 rating. For, you know, for that.
Oh God.
1 out of 10.
Oh no, is it really?
Yeah.
Well, I'll say just to
and
give
then
you
the smog rating is also 1 out of 10.
So here's your comparison to the Sonata hybrid. So you save $3,250 if you buy this. The smog rating is a 7 on a 1 to 10, and my fuel economy in greenhouse gases is a 9. Yeah. I am entirely we are opposing vehicles this week.
on the other hand, you know, I could park the TRX right on top of that Sonata and not even notice.
No, it's high enough. You might be able to park over the Sonata. Like, would it just clip the top of that solar roof?
Yeah. Almost. Might scratch it up a bit.
Just
though.
Scratch it a little bit. That's it. A little skid plates right on top of there. That's all.
Yeah. Sticking this in here in the middle of the show, because unfortunately,
Robbie was not feeling well last night and didn't set his alarm this morning for recording. So we're doing this after the fact, after Nicole and I recorded the rest of the show. But Robbie's here now to share with us stuff that he drove and rode in this week for the garage. And what did you drive? You had something a little bit different.
Well, I'm surprised I drove anything because clearly I can't participate in adult life because I don't know how to set an alarm clock.
alarm clocks are overrated. I mean, you alarm clocks are.
I do have a dog. I do have a dog. I have a cat who wakes me up. I have another cat who wakes me up. I have a lot of animals that wake me up. I also have allergies that knocked me out. So the allergies won today. But yeah. So I drove a couple things this week. I drove the Acura MDX, which y'all have already talked about, so I'm not even gonna dwell into that. I drove the Acura Type TLX Type S, which I'm actually not allowed to talk about yet, so I can't talk about that. So two Acuras, one we've already talked about, one I can't talk about, and then something completely different, the Daimler EM2, which is if you're scrambling to try to figure out what the hell I'm talking about.
It's not an E-Class.
It is not an E-Class.
It's not an M-Class.
It's not an M-Class. It is a panel truck. It is an electric panel truck. While Nikola and Tesla have been talking about making these giant electric trucks they're going to put on the road, Daimler's been doing it. You know, they've been working on their EM2 and their E-Cascadia. Both of them are Freightliners. Daimler owns Freightliner, if you weren't aware. Daimler owns a lot of the large
trucks. A bunch of different brands.
Yeah. You'd be surprised how much Daimler and Volvo own in the trucking world. Or Volvo trucks. Volvo and Volvo trucks are two completely separate.
Volvo Group, which is different from Volvo Cars Group.
Yes, it's a whole, yeah. Is it confusing? Yes. Does it make them a lot of money? Probably. So I rode in the E-Cascadia, which is the giant semi. And it has 360 to 525 horsepower and has a range of about 250 miles from a battery pack capacity of up to 475 kilowatt hours. Now, if you're thinking, well, they're never going to be able to drive from LA to New York, and that's not what this truck is for. It's essentially for getting things from the port to a warehouse, usually in an environment that is urban. So think New York, think Los Angeles, especially Long Beach, Pedro area, think Oakland, think San Francisco, Florida, anywhere where there's a port and you have to move large amounts of stuff from the port to a warehouse where then it gets sort of spread out either nationally or locally. And for additional local driving, they have the EM2, and that's what I got to drive. I don't have a class 8 commercial driver's license, so they didn't let me drive the semi, and I kind of didn't want to because I had the big trailer on it, and I'm sure I would have taken out half of Oakland with it. But I did to drive the EM2, which is a class 6-7, essentially like one of those big panel trucks you see driving around.
Yeah.
And
like the stuff when you order appliances or furniture, it's the kind of truck that'll be delivering that stuff, or a moving van.
Exactly. Yeah, like a large moving van. Or yeah, like you said, appliances or furniture, because typically they're delivering a couple things at once. It's a larger than your typical U-Haul, but not as large as a semi, if that helps. So I drove that, and it was a very it was a weird experience, because if you've ever driven or been in a large panel truck like this, you know that, you know, they're diesel, so they're loud. They have that diesel sound. They have a lot of torque. And it's funny, whenever you're in one of those vehicles and when you're about to go, you can feel a sort of torque shift. It sort of twists the entire body of the vehicle before it goes, and you get that little lurch. It's like, yeah. It didn't have any of that because it doesn't have a drive shaft. It doesn't have, you know.
Is the motor mounted at the rear axle?
Yeah, the motor's mounted at the rear axle. So it just goes, and it's quiet, and it's smooth, and it's very... And while I'm driving it, I'm pulling up to, because, you know, we were down by the airport, while I'm driving this vehicle, we're pulling up to other semis, other class 6-7 trucks, and they all have diesel engines, and there's like clack, 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 clack. You know, they have that diesel sound, and you can see, you know, as they go, you know, the cab shifts, everything, you know, everything you anticipate from a very large truck going forward. And then you're in this and it's quiet and you're just kind of cruising. And it is so weird. And the regenerative braking, they have 10 different settings. And so they want you to be able to adjust it on the fly. So right now the cab is they're redoing the cab. So the vehicles I drove are prototypes. They're using to show off to potential clients, people who are going to buy these. And then 2022, when they hit the road, they're also getting a cab redesign. But the sort of the push button shifter, it had a up and down, and you could adjust the amount of regenerative braking. So you can set it up all the way up to 90 if you're going downhill. You can set it down to 20 if you just, or 10 or 0 and just cruise. It was pretty great. And they were like, yeah, if you're going downhill, if you only have a few choices of regenerative braking, you might not be going fast enough. If we've all driven down here, you have regenerative braking, you kind of have to feather the accelerator in order to keep up with traffic. With this, you can adjust. You're like, well, there's too much braking. Let me adjust a little bit.
So you get more granularity in that control.
Yeah, they're getting more granularity in that control. It was pretty cool. Is what it was. First of all, it's automatically cool to drive a big truck.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are. You're driving this big giant truck. You sort of wish that if you're of a certain age, like me, the first thing that pops in your head is the song Convoy. For those who don't know, go look it up on YouTube. Make sure you look up Convoy and not Convoy 2. Convoy 2 is a horrible song. Convoy 1 is a little bit better. But in the late 70s, early 80s, it was sort of becoming a trucker was sort of a thing. And so, when you rope in that, it's pretty great. So it has, they're saying it's on the 400 volt architecture instead of like an 800 or 900, which I'm still, Mercedes is the same way. They're not, they're still on this 400 volt architecture, but they said it'll charge in 80% in about 90 minutes. They can get us and wait, I'm sorry, 80% in 60 minutes. The eCascadia is 80% in 90 minutes. It has a battery capacity of up to 315 kilowatt hours. The battery sits right under the cab. It has a range of 230 miles. It has 180 to 300 horsepower, but it has all this torque, of course, and they didn't give me any torque numbers because, it's a prototype. And yeah, there's probably going to be a little bit of a few changes here and there, especially, the cab is going to be completely redesigned. But for the most part, if you live in a city, you know that there are a lot of trucks that are driving around constantly delivering things here and there. They sort of become part of the background. But they also are part of, the pollution that's being, spewed into the air where you live. And, Daimler, Volvo, and to a lesser extent, Tesla and Nikola, just because we have no idea what's going on over there. They are working towards sort of eliminating, especially in cities, a pretty large amount of CO2 that's being released into the air. And especially now, because we have become so used to having things delivered to our home, like things have to show up to those Amazon warehouses somehow. And that involves, big giant trucks delivering them from ports to warehouses. So
you take the Cascadia from the port or from the airport where the 747 freighters are landing, take that to the warehouse. And then from there, it goes on to the smaller vehicles.
Yeah. And so, I drove the Mitsubishi Fuso, which a few years ago, which is a smaller sort of panel truck, which is also owned by Daimler. I know it's all very confusing.
There's been a lot of consolidation in the truck business. And VW Group also has a truck group as well. Which they spun off or they separated last year as Traton, which in Europe it has the Scania and MAN brands, but here in North America they just bought Navistar, so they're also working on electric trucks.
Yeah, it's interesting how much of the trucking business is owned by people you didn't realize. And, you know, I don't know if it's just, you know, people are used to the word, you know, they're used to Freightliner, they're used to Mac, they're used to, you know, mm-hmm. And so when you have those names that have a ton of history behind them, you know, when you buy them, you just sort of back off and let them do what they need to do. You know, in the trucking industry, you don't just buy a truck. Every truck is typically custom built. Initially, these won't have as much customization as a diesel truck, just because, you know, they're speeding up, you know, the production of them. So they won't have nearly as much customization, but they will get there at some point. So if you have a very, and every, you know, driver has some, or fleet manager has some sort of special need for their truck. So as long as what you need is available in these trucks, and there's a ton of, you know, just like your passenger EVs, there are a ton of federal incentives to sort of bring the price down. You know, it seems like there might be a little bit above parity. You know, it probably won't be parity, but there'll be a little bit more. But when you look at the long run, and that's what fleet managers and these trucking companies do, is they're looking long term. They're thinking about
the operating costs too.
Yeah, you know, exactly. So you're talking about maintenance fuel and service and oil changes and all this stuff. And, you know, there's still a lot of services you have to do on these trucks, but not nearly as much as you would on a diesel vehicle. So it's, you know, it'll be interesting next year to see how well these sell, how many end up in the market. And again, driving it was, I mean, if I could drive it,
So are they going to also offer the EM2, like, you know, I think that's the one you drove, and the ones they've shown are, you know, the box trucks, but
yes,
that same chassis, I think that they, and the diesel versions, they sell that for things like trash trucks and other applications too, dump trucks, flatbeds. Are they going to offer the electric version for those other use cases as well?
They wouldn't get too deep into what the customization was available for each vehicle, but I think, as you know, I think the goal is to get to that, because a trash truck just stops and goes all day. You really don't, you know, it's not exactly, you probably don't need more than 100, you know, miles.
Yeah, so it'd probably be range. a smaller battery version for that.
Yeah, but yeah, so you save money, you know, you have that. So, you know, they are talking about. Sorry, my dog is barking in the background.
That's okay.
You know, they want to be able to offer the customization throughout the entire line, but they said that it's going to be less initially and then more later on. So we'll see. I think that they that in the long run, and maybe even within a year or so, they'll probably, you know, again, if it sells well, then they're going to be selling them, you know, they're going to be manufacturing them in Oregon on the same plant they're building the other truck. So it's not like they have to build a special, you know, they have to adjust the line, but they're going to be building them on the exact same line. So okay. It's, you know, it's pretty smart, because, you know, building an entire facility just to make these trucks, especially at the beginning where, you know, maybe they sell a couple hundred versus the thousands upon thousands they're selling, seems a little insane, but it's, you know, they're easing into it, but they are, you know, they're out there, they're selling them, they're, you know, I met the team that's selling them. There's like, they got people showing up, they have whole days, they were here in Oakland, they were going to Fresno, they're just going cross country,
demonstrating them to fleets and so
demonstrating fleets, have fleet managers and trucking company owners and whatnot just come and drive the trucks and let them, if they have the CDL, commercial driver's license, and they drive the eCascadia, they do take the trailer off. So they let them drive.
Okay. The So, what was the Cascadia like?
It was sort of the same thing. It was, you know, you're sitting high, just a little bigger, and you can adjust the regenerative braking via a stock on the steering wheel. And so you can sort of push it forward, push it back, push it in. So you can adjust it on the fly. And they were talking about how one of the things they have to sort of teach the drivers is that they can do this. This is something that they can do to increase range and save energy, et cetera. And in the long run, save money for their overlords and their bosses. But it didn't
less
have
wear
the,
on the brakes.
Yeah. Less wear on the brakes. I mean, it was, but again, you know, you're sitting in this big truck and you're parked next to another Freightliner or, you know, some other truck, and it's making, you know, it's making that giant loud diesel noise that, if you know, if you're driving down the freeway, you're going to be, at some point you're going to be parked next to a semi truck, and they're not quiet. You know, sometimes when they take off, the little puff of smoke comes out of the top, even though they're not supposed to at this point.
Yeah.
You know, they have the, you know, you have to deal with engine brakes, which are very loud after 2007. You know, they, prior to 2007, the engine brakes were very loud. They had to like figure out a way to make those quiet. So if you live anywhere near a freeway, you know, that is, you know, that noise.
Yep.
That is the truck stopping. And with the regenerative braking, that won't happen anymore. So you don't have this sort of loud, annoying vehicle like sort of barreling through your neighborhood if you live in an urban area. You know, and it's less noise, less pollution, and I still get my socks that I ordered from Amazon. That's kind of
that's all you need.
that's all we want. All we want is better world.
Our stuff.
And all we want is a better world, but also our stuff. And, you know, these two trucks, it looks like that they're, you know, Daimler has a huge reach in the trucking industry. So I think they have a lot more pull than some of the automotive startups that are out there.
Yeah. And Daimler Trucks also owns Thomas Built, I think they're the biggest manufacturer of school buses in North America. And they're launching electric versions of those too, which I assume are going to use the same hardware probably across the Thomas Built buses as well.
Yeah. I'm sure they're going to have the same hardware. I mean, it's interesting because they don't really, because I asked about talking with the passenger division, with Mercedes-Benz. And they were like, well, we kind of talk, but not really. It's just not, you know, the difference between the engine, I'm sorry, but the motor in, you know, an EQS versus the difference in a motor in, you know, the eCascadia is, you know, that motor that I saw was huge. It's just, it was like half the size of a Beetle. It's just this giant electric, you know, beast. It just, and on the eCascadia, you can get a single or tandem axle. And it's just, it's pretty insane. And it's one of those things people don't really think about when they think about the electrification of transportation, is all the other cars that aren't passenger vehicles and all the other vehicles that are sort of, creating smog, creating noise, creating this, creating that. Because again, they're so big and they're so part of the background, and you just sort of shoot past them when you're driving, that I think people sort of ignore the fact. Until they get stuck behind one, then they're just like, why aren't there special roads for these people or for these trucks? And they're like, yeah, they're called trains and boats.
Yeah, exactly.
But at some point they have to get to from here to there. So it was really fun, just because anytime you get to drive a giant truck,
it's always fun to be in a big truck.
It is really fun to be in a big truck.
It's like being a little kid again.
Yeah. And I think some of the fatigue issues that you have, the drivers have with being a big truck, because of the noise and the vibration, like that is severely reduced. All you hear is the whine. So that's good for the drivers. If it reduces maintenance costs, that's good for the fleet. And if it reduces all the other things, you know, the sort of environmental issues, it's good for us. So it's sort of a win. And then I'll just keep saying win for 5 minutes if it all works out. I'm sure there'll always be people who are like, you know, when I was, you know, convoy, rubber ducky, you know, when they long distances, that, you know, I think that's where hydrogen comes in. That's where, you know, the hydrogen fuel cells really work. What Nikola's working on.
Daimler's Toyota, working on that too.
Yeah. Daimler's working on Toyota's been working on hydrogen trucks forever. They have a whole system set up down in Pedro in Long Beach area.
Yep.
So, you know, it's you know, certain tasks are certain tasks for certain powertrains. So it looks like, you know, a couple of years, you're probably going to, you know, next year, we're going to probably start seeing these Daimlers on the road. I think in 3 or 4 years, we're going to be seeing a lot more electrified vehicles on the road, whether they're battery powered or hydrogen fuel cell powered.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you said, that's going to make a big difference, especially in cities, you know, where these trucks are doing deliveries and so on. You know, they tend to be the biggest polluters, and you know, so it's going to make a huge difference in quality of life, both air quality and noise levels in cities and suburban areas too.
Yeah, yeah. The trucking companies and the fleet managers, they'll hold on to it something forever. And mm-hmm. so, you know, they'll just swap out the cab and throw it on top of an old motor or an old engine, old chassis. And so, you know, it's going to be a little while because, you know, they're every penny counts for them. But I think, you know, as the transition happens, eventually, you know, the trucks become more of an liability than they're worth. And then when that happens and they start looking at, okay, what's next? What's going to save me money in the long run? And for some of those, you know, some of those, especially the smaller ones, they're probably going to wait 3 or 4 years before they, you know, look into EVs or hydrogens. But some of the bigger companies where you're dealing with, you know, thousands and thousands of trucks every day, you know, if 10% of them are going to save you, you know, an additional 10% of your output in cash, then you're going to be pretty happy.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks so much, Robbie. And we'll get this spliced in and going to cut back now to Nicole and I talking about the Ford Explorer Timberline. Did you have any comments on the Timberline?
I don't have any comments on the Timberline. I think it's the sort of... I guess I do.
All right. Let's hear it.
Building the off-road capable anything that's based on just a regular SUV, and a regular SUV now is a passenger vehicle. It's a minivan without sliding doors. That's how I see right. large SUVs. They're fancy minivans without sliding doors, which makes them the worst minivan. I love mm-hmm. minivans. I think minivans make way more sense than SUVs. It seems like a lot of money for something you're going to take off road once or twice, maybe. And there are people, you know, and there are already vehicles that people buy specifically for off road. You know, they buy Jeeps, they buy 4Runners, you know, I was going to see maybe a few people buy Defenders for that. But for the money, they don't buy G-Wagons for it, which is a huge miscarriage of justice.
They only drive those in Beverly Hills.
Exactly.
Miami Beach.
Then no one takes these amazing vehicles off road. So it is a, you know, adding you're adding additional, you know, it's a lot of money for something you're never going to do, which is a very American thing for us to do. It's a, you know, we buy things
because we want, not because we need them.
Exactly. We think we're going to do a thing and then we don't.
Which is why you want your socks delivered tomorrow.
Which is why I want my socks delivered tomorrow instead of just getting into a car and driving to Target. But, you know, again, it's your money. If you want to buy this, if you're going to go off road, you know, thumbs up to you. If you're in a part of the country where you have to go off road or you have to deal with, you know, inclement weather and you want something a little extra, something in order to tackle that, just more than just, you know, all wheel drive, which is completely capable on any vehicle of handling, you know, and you get some good tires, you get some all wheel drive, you can do anything and anything. There are very few cars that are just going to like spin you into a ditch with all wheel drive and winter tires. You be you. How about that?
Exactly. It's your money. Spend it how you want.
It's your money. Spend it how you want. But maybe, I don't know, maybe just get a regular Ford Explorer and then get a Jeep or get something like, if you're going to go off road, like go off road, like, you know, be ready to like the zombie apocalypse. You can just drive over zombies and whatnot.
Yeah, or, you know, get a Ram TRX, which we were talking about earlier.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which will pretty much go anywhere. I mean, it's one of the most ridiculous vehicles you can possibly get. I mean, who the hell needs a 700 horsepower supercharged pickup truck? It sure is fun.
You can jump it over creeks.
Zero to 60 in 3.5 seconds on a bumpy back road.
Why do you need it? No one needs that much power, but people are going to buy it. And then 1%, 2% are going to spend some of their time off road. And most of those are because of this is where I live and this is what I do type situations. If you live in, you know, there are people who live in Colorado. There are people who live in Wyoming. You know, you need something that's off the road. If you live in, you know, parts of Hawaii, you know, you need something off road. If you live in Alaska, you need something that's off road. If you live in the Bay Area where I live, and there are so many of these types of vehicles, and there's so many big, large trucks. Unless you're hauling something, I'm kind of judging you. I'm sorry. I grew up in a town where everyone who had a truck was hauling something. We had to go, you know, we had horse trailers attached to these. We had like big bales of hay. You move things around in them. And then if you weren't doing that, then everyone just kind of like, why do you have that?
Yeah. I mean, here in Michigan, you know, I live in Southeast Michigan, but if you head north on I-75, almost any weekend of the year, you know, you're likely to find people with pickup trucks or big SUVs towing trailers with, depending on the time of year, either jet skis or snowmobiles or, you know, dirt bikes or something else. And so a lot of people around here do use them that way. A lot don't, but you know, a lot of people use them, especially for the towing capability.
Oh yeah.
But, you know, it's, you know, even, you know, even this thing, you know, the TRX is just total overkill. And as we were talking about, you know, it's probably going to be the, you know, this and the upcoming Raptor R, which we don't have any details on yet, but which may well have the supercharged V8 from the GT500 in it. That's the rumor anyway. You know, these are likely the end of an era, you know, because these are going to start to get supplanted by electric pickups that have even more performance capability, starting with the Hummer EV this fall and the Cybertruck and other stuff.
Yeah. I think that torque is going to be EV torque. It's such a game changer in so many ways because, and I feel like a broken record. And I say this every time somebody talks about EVs. If you put someone in an EV and let them drive it, they're going to want an EV because most of the time they're just going from stop sign to stop sign. And they like that little like extra oomph that an EV gives them, so, you know, because top end horsepower doesn't really matter if you just have this really nice bit of torque on the back end at the, you know, you just, ooh. Well,
it's the old, you know, it's the old saying, you know, people buy horsepower, but they drive torque. Torque exactly. Is what you feel. You know, it's the thing that gives you the drivability off the line. And, you know, of course, you know, with an EV, you get the torque, but you miss out on that sound. You know, there's nothing quite like the sound of a big ass V8.
That is incredibly true. I know I've had friends who are not even really car people get into, say, the Mustang Bullet, mm-hmm. and then just have the, you know, turn up the exhaust and just drive that, and they're just tickled pink. They are so happy with that noise. And if you were outside the car and they heard that car going by, they'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe what is this? But when you're inside the car and you are in control of that noise and that, and it is something else. It's very, it's a visceral, primal experience. And then when you have the EV, you kind of don't have that. You can, a couple cars have weird space noises. Woo! Yeah. But you know, when you drive around town, you kind of don't, you know, that gets old quick. And then it's so smooth that the lack of vibration, the sort of just sort of off the line. It is such a unique experience that people, again, just go to a dealership, find a friend with an EV and just drive it. And if you don't like it, then fine. You don't like it. But I guarantee you it's going to change your mind on EVs. If you're one of these people who are like, if it's either gas or nothing, I'm like, well, you know, it can be both.
Yeah.
Most American households have two cars. You can have both.
And a plug.
Yeah. We also have electricity.
All right. Thanks, Robbie.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next time. Couple of news items this week is a relatively slow news week. First thing, Ford launched a new variant of the Explorer this week, and it's actually going to be the first of another subfamily for their SUVs, the Explorer Timberline. And so they're going to be adding Timberline variants to a bunch of their other SUVs. You know, this is supposed to be a little more rugged looking, a little more off-roady version of the Explorer. You know, what do you think of this thing?
Cool. I guess I think it's neat. Isn't everyone kind of trying to do some sort of off-roady variant, either your luxury brand that's coming up with your Uber luxury thing like Denali mm-hmm. and Avenir, or you're not a luxury brand and you're trying to come up with your rugged off-road capable line for your whole thing. So I guess it makes sense, or isn't surprising maybe that they've done that. And it looks pretty good. I mean, I'm looking at the picture. It looks pretty slick. And it does have some genuine additional capability in there. It's not just an appearance package, because some of them do that. It's like, we made this look off-roady, but it's got a single thing different from the non-off-road version, you know?
Right. So this one, you know, it's got a different front fascia with, you know, it's cut away more. So you have a shorter or a steeper approach angle. They've got actual, you know, real skid plates on there, not just pieces of plastic molded to look like skid plates, but you know, they're actually protecting the important bits underneath.
Right.
Bridgestone Dueler off all-terrain tires, new dampers. You know, they've got some lights integrated into the grill on either side of the blue oval logo. I do like the dark green color that they're offering on this.
Is it just a dark green? I didn't get that part of it. Is it only in the dark green, or
it'll be available in other colors?
Okay, because sometimes they do that, like only with this color, you know?
Yeah. No. So they've got press photos of silver and the green, but the green is the hero color for this, you know,
because which makes sense. Timberline. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so they'll be adding Timberline variants to other, you know, probably certainly I think to the Bronco Sport, maybe the Edge. I don't know if they'll do it for the Escape or not. Cause they've taken the Escape and kind of diverged it from the Bronco Sport, you know, cause they're both on the same architecture. You know, and the Escape is more the car like, you know, crossover variant, you know, for street use and urban driving. But they're definitely going to do more Timberlines, going forward. Probably the Expedition will probably get a Timberline. And there's also a Torsen limited slip differential on the rear axle, a few other things. It does come with the 2.3 liter turbo, the EcoBoost four cylinder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it should be an interesting option.
I think it's probably good to be modestly more. I mean, it definitely has some capability. It'd be interesting to like just drive straight up Explorer and then drive this one back to back to see how much, like, can you feel that difference? Do you notice that difference? Do you feel the capability they baked into it, or is it, you know?
I think where you're likely to feel it most is just from having the all-terrain tires.
Yeah.
You know, just having more grip when you're off-road.
Right.
Because, you know, the all-season tires that they put on normal ones, you know, the Explorer, you know, is actually reasonably capable. A couple of years ago when they launched it, I did the drive program out in Portland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did some off-roading with it, and, you know, it's fairly capable even in standard form, like in an XLT form. And this, you know, is derived from the XLT, you know, just kind of stepping it up a little bit more. It's not quite up there, I would say, with something like Jeep's Trailhawk models, you know, which, you know, that's their off-road rated versions.
But they did even try. It's funny that you say that, because the tow hooks. Oh no, I lost the color. What do they call it? Jeep has those red tow hooks on the Trailhawk, which is like a signature.
They've got the red tow hooks on here,
but they're called Red Ember tow hooks.
Yeah, well, whatever.
Red Ember. Jeep. Does Jeep have a name for their red? I don't even know.
I think it's just red.
Just red? That's not very exciting.
No.
Come on, Jeep. Come up with a better name than just red.
I've always been shocked at how much effort they expend trying to come up with descriptors to add to the color names. You know, like Red Ember, you know, or Midnight Blue. Well, Midnight Blue is kind of boring, but, you know, some of the names that they come up with for the various colors.
Well, this is this ridiculous color, forged green metallic. What does that even mean? I mean, it sounds cool, but forged green, what, you like took it to a forge and you made the green? I don't get it.
Well, I mean, you know, if you stuck a piece of steel in a forge, it's not going to come out looking green like that.
It is not.
I'm not sure really what that is supposed to represent.
What does that mean? Yeah.
I don't know. But no pricing yet on this, but it should be out this summer, I think.
No, it looks good. I think it's probably
assuming they can get enough chips to build them.
Oh my gosh, there's such a you know what? I actually see the shortage on lots of vehicles from the chip shortage. You can see it. You drive by our local dealerships, it's like there's no cars out there.
Yep. Yeah, they're missing everywhere. Citroën, another one of the 14 Stellantis brands. You know, this is one of the most classic French brands. Last year they launched a car called the Ami, you know, which it's French for friend. You know, it's a little two seat pod. It's electric.
The friend.
I think it's like 8 horsepower or something like that. They designed it mainly for their Freedom Move mobility service that they offer. They launched it last year in Washington, D.C. and Portland, Oregon. They also have it in a bunch of European cities. And one of the things with the Freedom Move service is they have car sharing in there, but they also integrate some other services as well. So, you know, if you need a ride hail or something like that, you can use that to find, rides, you know, whether you want to drive yourself or have somebody else drive you. And I'm not sure exactly which services they're offering here in the US, but they're now including the Citroen AMI in their car sharing fleet in the Washington, D.C. area.
Wait, it has a top speed of 28 miles per hour. Am I reading that right?
Yeah.
Can you even?
It only has 8 horsepower.
I know, but at a range of 45 miles. Okay, so you really are just looking for the shortest little, like, I need to drive 6 blocks and it's pouring rain or freezing cold and that's it. Because you can't even get like on the...
Or to go to the grocery store, you know, something like that.
I guess. I mean, it's really cute. It's like the most adorable little car. It looks like something, you know what it reminds me of? The cars the kids have that are always yellow with like the red roof, that, you know, mm-hmm. little plastic cars. That
little Tiny Tykes cars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Looks like a Tiny Tykes car, but it's real.
Yeah.
I don't know though, at 28 with eight horsepower and a top speed of 28 miles per hour, I think my 7-year-old may have been able to beat it though. Her feet move pretty fast.
Almost, yeah.
Maybe.
Well, you know, I mean, think about it though, like in a dense urban environment, you're almost never going 28 miles an hour. Anyway.
This is true. But I'm just thinking like you could, I mean, like you could still, there's still.
Before the pandemic, the average speed in Manhattan was 8 miles an hour.
Okay. I mean, no, I get that. But I mean, you couldn't even for 1 second get off of like, well, even in Manhattan, when you go, I don't know the names of the roads, but you kind of, as you're exiting the city or coming into the city, there's sort of the sides that get kind of speedy fast. You wouldn't be able to hit the actual speed of traffic there. You would get run over by
you wouldn't
by
be able to drive it somewhere
taxi.
Like the West Side Highway or
yes,
something
that's
like
what
that.
I'm thinking of like that. You would be run over in a second and a hot minute. Absolutely. You would be run over. You'd be roadkill. So you really just have to intend to drive
and certainly a lot of New York City cabbies would run right over.
Oh yeah, thing. Boom, you're dead. Yeah. They run over you like the TRX over the Sonata. Yeah. you'd just be gone.
So it'll be interesting to see how popular these are going to be. They're doing it for a 6-month trial to start with.
And as I'm like picking on it, I mean, I get it's a cute car. It is a nice little solution if you really just need a super short jaunt. And it's adorable. It really is a fun little car.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how much they charge.
I know. I was scanning down the story and I don't see anything talking about pricing.
Yeah, I don't think that they've announced the pricing yet. And that's been one of the challenges. And I'm not sure, like with Freedom Move, you know, how they're doing it, whether it's, a free floating car share or you have to return the car back to where you picked it up from. Because this has been one of the problems with car sharing services and why they've kind of struggled to really gain enough traction in the U.S. market and even in other regions as well. You know, they started off, you know, like the Zipcar kind of model where the cars are parked in a specific location. You'd reserve a car, you go pick it up and you drop it back off at the same location. You didn't have to put in gas or anything or charge it. You know, that was all taken care of. You didn't have to worry about insurance. It was basically a short-term car rental. And then they went to, some companies went to free floating car share, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like what they do now with the scooters where, you know, you can just drop it off. You know, you don't have to take it back to where you picked it up from. You just drop it off anywhere.
Right.
And the problem with that is, it's actually really expensive to operate that because periodically you've got to have staff that go around, find the cars and relocate, reposition them.
Bring them
to
all
the places.
Back.
Yeah. Yeah. To bring them back to the places where people are actually trying to use them. Because,
right.
you know, if you drop one off somewhere where there's not much usage, it doesn't make any sense. So it'll be interesting to see if they can actually make a go of it. You know, most of the other car share programs like GM shut down their Maven program last year. BMW shut down their Reach Now or Ride Now or something, Drive Now. I forget
what they call something it. Now, but it's no longer.
Daimler,
so.
Yeah. Daimler had their car to go. They've all been shut down because they couldn't make any money off of it. So,
but you wonder where this is, because this is such a cheap little car. You know, yeah. It's not like it's not the same investment in capital as those, you know, yeah, with these tiny little cars.
My guess is it will probably be, return it to where you picked it up from so you can plug it back in.
Right. Yeah. Otherwise, you just leave it there. You sit it there and you run it down, and now your car is dead in a parking lot. Good luck.
Yeah. All right. Enough of the Citroën friend.
Yes. The Ami.
So we had one listener email this week from Brian McMillan. Say, good morning, afternoon, or evening. First off, I just want to say how much I love the show and appreciate what you all do. While the news of Rebecca and Dan's departure is certainly saddening for the listeners, it does seem that Nicole and Roberto have picked up right where they left off. Keep up the good work.
Aww,
thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
As a recent ICE to BEV converter, so that's internal combustion to battery electric, converter, pun intended. I wanted to share my thoughts, experience in regards to your discussion on episode 191 when answering a listener's question about buying an ICE versus an EV. My wife and I have always been road warriors when it comes to travel, as she's not particularly fond of flying. So in 2014, we purchased a brand new Dodge Caravan and proceeded to put close to 100,000 miles on it in 5 or 6 years. While we still own this vehicle, it is rarely used anymore, as both kids are out of the house and our daily driver is a Tesla. My Tesla is a 2020 Model 3 long-range all-wheel drive and has become our new road trip mule. Between work and pleasure travel, I've put more than 6,000 miles on her in about 6 months. That's right. That's right around the average. The average is about 12,000 miles a year.
So he's right in there.
Yeah. With our longest road trip traversing over 1,500 miles round trip. Our experience has been that road tripping in an EV, specifically a Tesla, is actually better for our needs driving style. We've always been the type of family that enjoys the journey and when traveling, stopping as needed for bathroom and snack breaks, not eating meals in the car, and typically never driving straight through to our destination. So with our Tesla, that combination of autopilot and charging stops makes the trips much more enjoyable and relaxing, while not adding extensive trip time versus ICE travel. While there is no doubt that road tripping with an EV will add time to your trip, there are ways to maximize it, like staying at hotels with destination charging along the route. From our experience, these destination chargers are abundant, free, and fairly easy to find with a search on Google Maps. Then for supercharging along the route, stations are easily accessible, strategically placed, such that range anxiety is not an issue at all. While Tesla does get a bad rap for various reasons, and deservedly so in some cases, I can absolutely recommend a Tesla today to anyone that likes to road trip for the reasons mentioned above. And I have to agree, you know, I mean, for the thing, you know, all the things I've complained about with Tesla, the thing that they've done the most right is the build out of the supercharger network. Yeah, because it convinced people that you can go anywhere with an EV. Yeah, and they've got currently about 1,000 locations across the U.S. With about 10,000 chargers. So there's an average of about 10 chargers per location. Some are 6, some are 12 or 18, and you know, some of the really popular spots. But yeah, I mean, that is absolutely a really smart thing that Tesla did. And, you know, Electrify America and other companies are trying to replicate that now with their networks. But there's, you know, they're not there yet. You know, Tesla or Electrify America has about 600 locations now. But I think one of the things that Tesla has also done well is they've generally done a pretty good job with reliability of their superchargers. And that's something where a lot of the other charger networks have had challenges, is with reliability.
That's what I see here, because I agree with everything that he said there, especially with Tesla. But I mean, I see in my area the number of times that the charging stations that are not Teslas just aren't working. You go up and there's just, you can't even get them to work, or you seem to have done everything right. You plug it in, something's not the cable, something is not right. Something's been, you know, there are very frequently issues with the actual physical chargers that are around us. We don't have as many in New Hampshire. It's a function of just where I live. But the, Tesla, there's a bunch of superchargers at a rest area on a major sort of thoroughfare heading up to the White Mountains, which is anybody who's traveling north to come like vacation up here, you're going to go buy them. So if you've been traveling from New York or Massachusetts or wherever, there's a good stop for you. You can stop, you can get some, you know, get something to eat, take a bathroom break and charge your vehicle. And I frequently see Teslas there. Like sometimes on like busy, busy weekends, there's maybe only one or two open spots, but that means there's quite a few people that are charging and having no problem doing it. So I definitely think like what you're describing there, Brian, I totally get it. And I think if you're the kind of person who travels that way in a road trip, and I like to travel that way, I don't generally just get in the car, drive as fast as I can on the busiest highway, get there and be done with it. I also like to stop and check stuff out too. And I think if that's your style of road tripping, they're much easier to live with, Tesla or otherwise. But if you're on that, I think back to when I was in college and that road trip where, you know, you're just coming home from school or you're, you know, and you've got to drive 14 hours of driving and you just want to knock that out as fast as you can. That's when, you know, that's when it becomes more of a challenge, which is, you know, I don't know. How many people do you think are doing a road trip because they're really trying to stop along the way, or how many are really focused on the destination? I don't know, Sam, like how does that play out? You know?
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, there's clearly a split there. I don't know what the split is. You know, but I think a lot of people, this is, as we start to continue to build out the charging infrastructure across the country, this is one of the things that needs to be thought about is, you know, where you locate these chargers. You know, you want it. You know, the reality is that even with DC fast charging, you know, you're going to be sitting around somewhere for probably, you know, a half hour or so at a minimum. If you're going from near empty and you want to fill it up to get, you know, maximize your range, you're probably going to be sitting around for anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes, at the least. And so you need to have those chargers located somewhere where you've got, you know, some sort of amenities, you know, certainly bathroom, but, you know, something to eat or, you know, other things that you can walk to see. And, you know, this is another one of the challenges, you know, is not just putting it, you know, putting the charger, you know, at just random rest areas, but ideally putting them somewhere where people have some options of other things to do for a half hour or an hour, while they're waiting for the vehicle to charge. And, you know, but I still think that, you know, the biggest challenge is the reliability. John Volker, you know, recently wrote something about this. He was testing the VW ID4 and, you know, he went to a couple of different Electrify America stations and granted, EA did have, a problem with a bunch of their charging stations, particularly on the East Coast, with one of the vendors that was supplying the chargers themselves. And they have since ended their relationship with that particular supplier and converted over to another supplier. But you know, this is not an issue exclusive to EA. ChargePoint, Blink, EVgo, I've had issues with all of them at some point in time or another, where you plug it in, nothing much happens. Yeah. You know, GM just announced last week, the Ultium 360 charging network. You know, so within their app for their vehicles, they're integrating, I think, to start with, six different charging networks, you know, so ChargePoint, EVgo, Blink, Green Lots, and a couple of others. And they're going to have 60,000 chargers.
Wow.
That are accessible through there, that, you know, you'll be able to see them on the map, you know, in the vehicle, you know, you can plot your route, easily. And this is something that automakers also need to do, is make that better integrated. So, you know, when you put in your destination, if your destination is 500 miles away and you've got 250, 300 miles of charge, you know, have it automatically show, okay, here are the places where there's chargers available that you can go and use. And, you know, ideally, you know, have a filter on there where you can put other things that you want. You know, so if there's a charger, you know, if you want to, you know, have a lunch break or, you know, go to a museum or something, you know, find those other things nearby as well.
I had a Bolt EV at one point and was looking for a charger. We went down to the Cape down that way. And so we were coming back. It's not a super long drive, but, you know, and was looking for some place where I could charge it and thought we found a place, and we get there. And it's literally the strangest thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, we're in this sort of old abandoned like mill buildings in the city in Massachusetts. There's one office here. And then in this parking lot where there is nothing except like it looks like no one's parked in this parking lot in 30 years. It's like half overgrown. There's one EV charger. And so we're driving up and I'm kind of like, huh, so do I just leave this car here and then wander about and see if there's some place where we, like, it was weird. I'm like, that, I'm sure there was some method to the madness when that was put in, but if it's sending you to a charging station like that, and it wasn't like the Bolt sent us there, it was just like, that's what we found when we searched. It's like, this is not helpful because I'm not just parking here and wandering about this area. I feel like I could, they will never see me again. They will find the car and nothing else, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think about 3 years ago at the, there's this event every summer in Traverse City in Northern Michigan called the Management Briefing Seminars, put on by the Center for Automotive Research. And my friend, Bob Gritzinger, who writes for Rewards, he had a Bolt press car that he was going to drive up to Traverse City. And it's about 250 miles from Metro Detroit area up to Traverse City, which is generally, you know, within the range of what the Bolt can do. And, you know, he had planned to stop along the way, you know, to top it off, you know, just to make sure that he got there safely. And he stopped at, you know, two of the charging locations that were identified in the nav system were at offices of Consumers Power, which is one of the two main utilities here in Michigan. And he stopped at the first one. The charger was there, but it was not working. Went to the second one. Same thing. Charger was not working. Eventually you get off I-75 and you take some secondary roads to get to Traverse City. He found a spot where he and his wife could grab some lunch and plug it in for an hour or two, you know, to get some more miles or get some more miles in the battery, and managed to get it to Traverse City. And then when he got to the hotel where the event was, the Grand Traverse Bay Resort up there, they had five chargers there. Two of them were Tesla only chargers. The other three were CCS chargers. The three CCS chargers, none of them were working. The two Tesla chargers were occupied, but, you know, couldn't use those anyway, but were working, but none of the CCS chargers were working. And, you know, they were being operated by some small network charging network provider, you know, located, I think, in Washington State. And Bob tried to get on the phone with them to see if they could reset it, see if they could do something. They couldn't get them working. Finally ended up, around the grounds, you know, around the hotel, you know, in the wintertime, they have all these Christmas lights. So they have plugs that they have set up all around the area.
Did he unplug Christmas lights to plug in his car?
Well, the Christmas lights weren't plugged in there, but he saw the little post with the, you know, with the outlet on there, just a standard 110 volt outlet. And since we were going to be there for 4 days anyway, you know, he just plugged it into a standard one, you know, took the cord and plugged it in and used that. And by the time it was time to go home, it was charged back up again. But, you know, I mean, this is the kind of ridiculous thing that both automakers and the charging network providers, you know, if they want to get people to adopt EVs, you know, they have to do what Tesla has done and really make that process seamless.
I think that's the biggest thing, that when, you know, it's not so much, I mean, I know we would say range anxiety. It's not that, it's not almost that you're going to run out of range before you get where you're going, but when you get where you're going, will what's supposed to be there actually be there? And will it actually work? Which is, it's a different thing. It's not like I'm going to run out before I get there. It's like, no, I planned everything just perfectly. I will get here. I'll be able to charge. What do you mean all four of your charging stations are not working? Now what do I do? Where's the nearest one? Well, you got to go a town over because you're on vacation and you're someplace rural. It's like, well, now what do I do? You know, it's that inconsistency with being able to charge when you get there. That's a huge obstacle for a lot of people.
It is. And so that's something that the industry really needs to address. You know, if GM hopes to sell a million EVs by 2025, they're going to have to fix this. And same goes for Ford and everybody else. You know, these things need to be as reliable as a gas pump. I mean, it's pretty rare that you go to a gas station and there's no working pumps.
Right. Like there's one pump that's not working out of the 15 that are there or something, you know, there's, and if not, even if that one pump, even if you have a gas station, for some reason, a gas station is having an issue, there's a pretty darn good chance you can drive 5 miles down the road or across the street. And there's another gas station. Like, it's just, you're like, okay, well, that's kind of a pain in the butt. I wanted to go to this one. I'll go across the street or right down the street. What, that is not always an option with EVs. It's just not. Maybe it will be at some point, but until it's that easy to get past the, it's not working when I get here, there has, that's going to be an obstacle for a lot of people.
It certainly is. All right. Got anything else for this week?
No, I think we're good.
All right. Well, that has been episode 195 of Wheel Bearings. Hopefully we'll have Robbie back next week.
What happened to him? Where'd he go? Did he sleep in?
Maybe there was an earthquake.
I mean, was there an earthquake in California? Because that would be sad if we're picking on him.
There was, one earlier this week. I think there was a decent sized one. But I mean, that's, you know, pretty much a daily occurrence.
I know. It's like, when isn't there an earthquake in California?
when you live in the Bay Area, you know, having the ground moving under your feet is not an unusual
thing.
That's
the norm. So
hopefully that's not the case today. Okay. But we'll catch up with Robbie next week.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everyone.